Hello and welcome to Book City Roanoke. I'm Douglas Jackson, and today in Book City, I'm sitting down with Mark Glenn Ferguson. Mark has a blog, The Revivalist, Word from the Appalachian South, and it's celebrating 10 years this year. But before we start the conversation, I want to plug a little bit of what we do here at Book City Roanoke. Book City Roanoke's a lab for exploring books and writing and their role in community building and placemaking. In the podcast, I speak with authors, readers, and what we call city builders, people shaping lives and community through literacy and literary efforts here in the region. The podcast is brought to you by our founding sponsor, Book No Further, Roanoke's independent bookstore, putting ideas in your head since 2017 down on the Roanoke City Market. And this season, we're focused on the theme of the next chapter, books, writing, and the personal renaissance. And with that, good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here today. I'm excited to talk both about the blog and your retail adventure here in Roanoke as well, which we'll get to, I think.
Great.
So let's dive right into this from the beginning. The beginning of the blog. Why did you start the blog?
Well, you know, it's been 10 years. Time flies. It's hard to believe. Yeah, 10 years ago, I hadn't written a word that had been published, and I was living in Washington, D.C., some 280 miles from here, and it was a confluence of things. I missed my homeland. Like, I missed the mountains. It's part of my heritage. My family has lived in the region for literally centuries, and it's in my blood. And, you know, I even carried little pieces of it with me from place to place when I moved to North Carolina, and then I moved to Boston, and then I moved to DC. I had my dad's baby blanket that was made by his great grandmother. I had a lock from the house that my great 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 grandparents built with the involuntary help of slaves, if we're being completely honest. And all of those pieces of Appalachia were always with me in every home that I had, but that wasn't enough. I really wanted to play a role in the region, even if I couldn't live in the region. So that was one set of reasons for starting The Revivalist. The other probably aren't quite as altruistic or flattering. I was also starting to write at the time, and I was writing these very personal pieces that in retrospect maybe weren't the most well-crafted work ever produced, and I was getting a lot of rejection letters. Even well-crafted work gets a lot of rejection letters, so this stuff was just guaranteed to not be accepted. And I was getting frustrated. I was getting tired of being told no over and over again, so it was a little bit of just like, screw you. Forget it, a literary elite. I'm going to publish my own work. So it was a combination of motivations that set me searching WordPress for a template that was off the shelf and very, very ugly initially, and starting to publish my own pieces.
So what did that do for you? Once you started publishing and building a readership through the blog, how did that change your writing?
Well, first, it just amazed me. Like, you know, I was fully prepared to have my mom and maybe some aunts and cousins read it, and that would be the beginning and end of it. But then other people started coming along, and thanks to social media, like, it was a little community started to form around The Revivalist, and it was people who are excited about Appalachia, I think smart, intellectually curious folks who were sort of at the same time I was taking a deeper look at the region and rediscovering the region and learning more about our heritage. I think they were doing that too. And that's actually one of the things that I've really seen pick up momentum over the last 10 years. Across the region, I've seen so many more people exploring traditional Appalachian music, Appalachian foodways, taking a fresh look at the natural resources that we have in this region, which are extraordinary. I mean, there are few places in the world that compare to what we have. It's one of the most biodiverse regions on the planet. So as I was rediscovering all that, I was also watching them rediscover all that, and we were able to enter into this dialogue about it. So that was remarkable. In terms of my writing, I mean, obviously, like, practice does not make perfect, but it certainly improves. You know, for blog writing, it did get better by way of blogging. And then, you know, like I did take active steps, like going and getting an MFA, because eventually I was like, okay, well, I've plateaued. I've taken it as far as I can on my own. I need a little bit of help. I need some expertise.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are lots of reasons for that resurgence of interest in Appalachian culture. What are some of the things you think that have sparked that?
You nationally have, like, I think people started looking back to look forward in a lot of ways. People started moving back into the urban cores of cities, which in some ways felt regressive after, you know, we grew up in the 70s and 80s. We saw everybody flee cities and live in the suburbs. And when you went shopping, you went to this bubble surrounded parking lots, and everybody lived by way of malls. Going back to urban areas was in some ways looking back. Americana music made a resurgence nationwide. Again, looking back, the Appalachian version of that was fueled, I think, by the same impulses. Plus, we have a rich heritage like nowhere else. I guess if you live in New Jersey, you can look back and you have something rich there, but frankly, if you live in Appalachia, you have something really special. You have this distinct heritage that in many ways was born out of isolation. We were hard to get to, right? Before highways, mountain people were largely isolated from the rest of the country and developed their own shorthand verbally. We had our own language. We had our own unique dialect. We had our own unique music. We did really creative things with food. Something like vinegar pie comes to mind. Like, you know, like that kind of ingenuity is born out of necessity. And we learned to make everything because we often couldn't trade, right? It was hard to trade when you didn't have an interstate running through the middle of your state. So we have so much richness to look back to. Why wouldn't you want to look back?
Yeah, that's really well said. And I like how you even started this with the things that you carried with you from Appalachia as you moved around. And that material culture is really important in Appalachia. And you feel people connect to it and respond to it. And in addition to that, the literary culture in Appalachia is rich. And I know that in your blog, you review books and you promote books that are written in Appalachia, and you continue the conversation off of the page of the book onto the blog. What are some books that you think, if someone wanted to better understand Appalachia, that you would first recommend?
Oh God. To truly better understand Appalachia. I'm a big fan, and I'm totally partial on this, of Sugar Run by Misha Marin. Came out last year. Misha and I were classmates in our MFA program, and I workshopped with her and remain good friends with her. I think that it is a unvarnished look at Appalachia. Scott McClanahan, books like Crapalachia. Obviously, these are the grittier sides of the region. I think, frankly, it's hard through literature to see the region as it is. When you write, you're inherently focusing on something that's full of conflict, and so often you're drawn to darkness, violence, not the day-to-day mundane life. And in Appalachia, that day-to-day mundane life takes on extra importance because our region has been so misportrayed nationally. And there's a long history of that dating back 150 years where people outside the region have relied on tropes about hillbillies, have portrayed us as violent, have portrayed us as ignorant, have portrayed us as backwoods. And to correct that, what you actually have to look at is kind of the boring stuff. You know, you have to look at everyday life and see that there are people who are educated. There are people who read. There are people here who, you know, there is a rich literary tradition. There are people here of economic means, which actually, sadly, to this day, I still encounter this when I'm outside the region. It surprises people that there are people who are middle class and upper middle class in Appalachia. In fact, most people are doing okay. There are higher poverty rates than in other parts of the country, especially in former coal country. Obviously, that part of Appalachia is really struggling. But the other half of Appalachia, if you look at places like Roanoke and Asheville and Knoxville and Greenville, the Shenandoah Valley, like those areas actually are some of them are totally thriving. I mean, Asheville is off the charts. And others are really stable. Shenandoah Valley is actually doing really well. And they have been for a while. If you look at the poverty rate change between 1960s and 2010, the number of high poverty counties in Appalachia dropped by about half. So it's a region that I think defies a lot of stereotypes when you peel back the onion. Doing that through literature, though, is actually kind of tough because often literature is going to focus on the negatives.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it doesn't have to be literature either. You know, there are the nonfiction books out there that are...
Right.
That, and interestingly, you know, I think part of it, you know, the work of the Appalachian Regional Commission, you know, over decades, as a region rallies those federal resources, you know, it's always been part of the game to tell the worst story that you can in order right. to rally the resources. But that really does a disservice as well.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Oh, it is. You've got to really quickly switch to that asset development.
Right.
Here's what we've got that's unique to us that we can really create something from, and we are rich in this, and it's a region to be proud of. And then, you know, how do we go from there, and still have those resources?
And not to go down too much of a rabbit hole, but I will. My background's in marketing and fundraising. Most of my marketing work has been with nonprofits. There was one point where we were doing work with an organization called Child Reach, which is now Plan USA, and they help children and communities in developing countries, many of them in Africa. We were doing advertising for them. They had this old ad from the 1980s. Angela Lansbury was the narrator. It was totally flies in the eyes advertising, right? It's like these destitute looking children starving with literal flies in their face, and they would run it on television, and it would raise a ton of money because people felt pity. Mm-hmm. We developed an ad that showed communities on an upswing, looking hopeful, running water, smiling faces. Angela Lansbury beat our butts. She yeah. outperformed it. And this ad at that point was almost 30 years old. But pity and pain raises money. That's the hard reality of fundraising. So I, as a marketer and fundraiser, deeply understand why groups like the Appalachian Regional Commission, even former presidents, have focused on the most painful images that they can find in Appalachia because they know that's going to rally support. The problem, of course, is it misportrays the region on the national stage and leaves people thinking that's all there is to Appalachia.
Yeah. If I were doing a fun drive right now, I would put on my puppy dog eyes and put a really sad sound in my voice and say, you've got to keep us on the air.
Right.
But I'm not going to say that because we have a sponsor for the podcast, and that's Book No Further down on Roanoke's historic city market. And Dolores Vest is the proprietor there, and you can stop in and visit with her and check out her selection of Appalachian books. Right when you walk in the door, it's right on the left-hand side. Spend some time, and I hear they sell really well there. So stop in and see what she has on the shelf. And I am here with Mark Lynn Ferguson here in Book City, Roanoke, and we're going to continue the conversation. And I'll switch a little bit, we'll continue talking about Appalachian culture and that material culture, and talk about what you've got going on down at Crafteria and the what you've put together there. How do you describe Crafteria?
Yeah, so if you're familiar with the old S&W cafeteria building in downtown Roanoke, it's seen some changes in the last year. Back in April, my partner Alex Dykes and I started Crafteria, Handmade Food and Goods. It is two big parts. One part is a maker's market, and it has work from about 70 craftspeople. Many of them are local to the Roanoke area. We also have a section that's tied to the revivalists called Appalachian Revival. All of that, the products in that section are made across the Appalachian South and represent, I think, a really amazing array of talents and visions. Some of them are very traditional. We have these beautiful wooden spoons that are coming out of West Virginia, very traditional crafts. We also have these very hip, beautiful, angular earrings coming out of Knoxville. So the kind of work that's being produced, again, I think defies stereotypes about what Appalachia is and should be. And then we also have in Crafteria a section of small batch food, and that comes from across the South. Really creative food entrepreneurs out there.
And the people who come in and shop, and the stories they're telling you, and the questions they're asking, and their comments about Roanoke, what are you hearing?
You know, the thing that's been most surprising to me are the number of tourists that we're getting now. You know, I see it reflected in the numbers around nights and hotels and things like that. So I knew it was happening theoretically, but every day somebody's coming in from somewhere else in the country or somewhere else in the world. And that's been eye-opening to me. And then people who are local, because it's part of our heritage, making things by hand. Again, we had to for so very long. And we have a market at the center of our city that's been there since its inception and managed to stay open through, you know, the darkest days of people of means leaving urban cores. Our market managed to stay open, and it's still with us today. I think for Roanoke especially, that fosters an appreciation for things that are grown locally and made locally. People have been really excited. Both the public as buyers, but also makers. Like, we've met so many talented people, and they've kind of flocked to us. And, you know, they're doing classes and workshops, and they're bringing in their goods and showing them to us. And we've just been amazed at what we're seeing.
Great. That this theme of transformation, and I can only imagine that some of the vendors you're working with, because the space is a great space if you're starting something out. You're creating something, you're making it, you're getting some product. How are you going to introduce it to the consumer in a climate where folks are going to be open to it, and you might get some support from some other vendors and the proprietors, of course? Are you seeing any transformations across your vendors?
I'm seeing our vendors have a lot more free time. They, you know, when you're doing craft shows, it's super time consuming, the setup, the breakdown, the planning, the, you know, merchandising your product. We make that process, I think, simpler for them. They bring it in, they set up their booth kind of like you would at an antique mall, except it's handmade products, and they're done. And they're able to go home and make these beautiful things. We handle the sales, the customer service. We give them a report at the end of the month so they can see what their figures look like. So we're taking, I think, a lot of that burden off of them. And that's just for the folks who are making physical goods that are in the maker's market. We also have a commercial kitchen. The building was once a cafeteria, and that kitchen is still back there. We use that as a community kitchen now, so you become a member. And if you're a food entrepreneur, you suddenly have access to this very large, well-equipped commercial kitchen. So we have makers of all kinds, both food and goods.
Great. How many folks are making things in the kitchen now? How many cooks are in the kitchen?
Gosh, I think we're up to four or five. I've lost count. Have more coming on board all the time. We're having conversations with a lot of folks right now who are interested. I'll go ahead and go. This is the first time we've talked about it publicly. We're also setting up a food walk-up window in the back. So those makers, if they're making fresh food, they'll be able to sell it directly to the public from our food walk-up window.
Oh, great. And you know, having an office just down the, just a block away, I'm looking forward to that.
You'll have new food options.
Terrific. And I think it's interesting, and of course Mass General Stores coming in right next door to you, and you know, and they're out of Boone, North Carolina, and or you know, communities all across the region. If you ask them what they want for their downtown, they'd say, "Oh, we want a Mass General Store." So of course we're really excited that's coming in, and I think in Roanoke's identity, it's pretty interesting. You know, we've always looked at Asheville, I think it's a community that for a while is really kind of annoying. People always said, you know, compare themselves to Asheville, and well, we can be something else. And it, you know, of course there are wonderful things about Asheville, and it's the other city along the Blue Ridge Parkway, and so there's some reasons why we would look to it. But Roanoke for a long time, you know, and I'm not sure how many people, if you talk to in Roanoke, they would say they lived in Appalachia. You know, there was a point where Roanoke could have opted in to be part of the Appalachian Regional Commission, and they chose not to because of the stereotype. But it's interesting now seeing people, you know, gravitate toward that identity. And I think that you know, your store, Mass General Store, you're going to have a little cluster down there of kind of good old mountain goodness.
It is going to be good old mountain goodness. And it's, you know, gosh, we couldn't ask for a better neighbor with Mass General Store. I mean, they're going to be spectacular. They become a tourism draw in their own right. They sell terrific products that will complement ours without, frankly, competing directly. So that's terrific. Our spot is off the market. And while I love downtown Roanoke, it does have a retail problem once you leave the market. Mast is a step forward in helping grow retail away from the market area. So that's going to be a big help for us. The Appalachian identity here is tricky for all the reasons that you just said. And I can't tell you how many times I've had the conversation, where is Appalachia, right? Like, where are the boundaries of Appalachia? I sure don't think it's the definition that the Appalachian Regional Commission uses. It was a creation of politics. Mm-hmm. There were places like Roanoke and most of the Shenandoah Valley, actually, that opted out because of the stigma that was attached to that word, Appalachia. And then there were a lot of places that opted in that, when you look at a topographical map, don't look terribly Appalachian to me once you get into the deep South. So a lot of politics went into drawing that map. For me, I'm a bit of a geographic purist. If there are mountains and they're part of the Appalachian Range, I think that you're easily in. And then there's some places like, you know, Charlottesville. You still have tiny mountains, Monticello by definition, tiny mountain, large foothills. And I think places like that are arguably Appalachian as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as you're now 10 years into the Revivalist and you're reflecting back, what are your thoughts?
Well, they're wide ranging. Like I said, the region, I think, has changed a lot. There's a growing pride in the region. There's also a growing economy in the region. Asheville, you mentioned, it's the shining star on the hill. For better or worse, like, it's a boom town, and that's brought its own set of challenges for that city, but it's also brought a tremendous amount of opportunity. I think Roanoke should always be Roanoke, and we should look at our local assets and resources and identities. Roanoke also can learn from other places. So studying the success of Asheville and Chattanooga and Greenville and other similarly sized cities in the mountains that have done very, very well doesn't hurt us at all. So I think that we can ride that updraft that's happening across the region. I'm also reflecting a lot personally on how I ended up starting the Revivalist and, frankly, how I ended up back in Roanoke. I grew up here in the 1980s in Northwest, two blocks from a massage parlor that was a poorly disguised brothel and a lot of really rough bars. We were flat broke, grew up very poor. We didn't have a car. We were on public assistance. We were on Section 8. We walked everywhere in an area of town that was not designed for walking. And in all weather, walking a mile to the grocery store, walking a mile back with a lot of groceries in your hands at age 7, 8, 9 is not a good time. We've talked about this directly. I was badly bullied growing up. I was conspicuously poor, so wearing like tattered hand-me-down clothes, small, and kind of lispy. And that was every bully's, you know, perfect target. So that made for a rough childhood. And I spent a lot of years wanting to leave Roanoke and working very hard, frankly, to find my out. And then I left and moved to other places and built a career and had a lot of fun and made a lot of friends and saw what the rest of the world looked like. But I was carrying those little pieces of Appalachia around with me and those little pieces of home, no matter where I went, that quilt, that lock, books about the region, and always stayed connected and always cared. I think it's hard for a lot of people who exit poverty. They often leave the place that they grew up poor, and to go back, I think, is painful. It was for me. It was painful to remember growing up that way. It was very painful to watch people that I love still struggling here, and they were. While I was, you know, building a marketing career where I was working with the occasional celebrity and doing these campaigns that had national reach and getting a graduate degree at Harvard and doing these things that weren't making me any money because I was working for nonprofits, but sounded, you know, sexy and were a lot of fun. Folks here were, you know, working security at Best Buy, working at one of those rough bars on Williamson Road. I've had relatives who were living in collapsing trailers. I had a relative who lived under a bridge for a while. I had relatives who had bed bugs for years on end because they couldn't afford to heat treat their house. So that dichotomy always ate at me. It was always very difficult to watch their struggle and help where I could, but not very much because, again, nonprofits. It also made it challenging to decide to come back. But the love for Appalachia was too big. The love for Roanoke and my family here was too big. And I was watching this region change and some really incredible things happen. And while I had the blog up and running, I wanted to be a deeper part of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. If you could, this is a cliche question, but if you could talk to your 8, 9-year-old self who's walking down the street with the groceries in hand and not feeling so great about where you are, what's happening to you, and in those situations you don't feel great about yourself because other people make you not feel great about yourself, what would you say?
You're worthwhile, you know? When you, when you're poor, you're dehumanized. People just don't treat you well. I remember standing in the food stamp line, in the city building downtown, with mom and, people just giving her like a ridiculous amount of attitude and a hard time, and just showing her no regard or respect, because she was poor. Then couple that with, you know, violence from my peers on a daily basis. I felt pretty low. So just knowing that I had value, and that I had something to contribute in this world, when I did start to discover that, meant a lot.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like in communities we're continuing that same cycle? Do you think things are better today, or do you have any sense of that, just in the way we treat each other and understand each other?
Treating and understanding, I think, varies so widely. It comes down to the individual level, and I don't feel like I personally have a sense of whether I just know kind people or whether nationally or even regionally, we're treating one another better. Economically, though, obviously we're more polarized as a nation than we ever have been. Those with wealth have now extraordinary wealth that's almost unimaginable. And those who don't have wealth are suffering more and more and more, and life is getting harder and harder and harder. And obviously that's, I've said for years that that would eventually lead to uprising of some kind. I wasn't necessarily picturing the kind of uprising that we saw in 2016. I wasn't anticipating that a candidate would come along that gave a big middle finger to all those elites who had looked down their noses at poor people for so long and had chosen to ignore them and not advocate for them. It's not the person I would have chosen, but I totally understand why so many people who were hard up gravitated to President Trump at the time. Mm-hmm. It's a direct outgrowth of 30 or 40 years of neglect of people who are low income. I would argue that this administration's done very little to help them. It's fed them a really great line, but we're no better as a nation, unless you're in the top 1%, than we were prior to 2016.
Mm-hmm. And how about, one final question, how about that contribution that you are actively making in the community and in the larger Appalachian community? How does that feel now to be back in Roanoke and to be part of it?
Terrific. Like I said, I tried really hard to leave this town, and I never imagined myself moving back. And I certainly never imagined myself loving it here. But I love it here. It's such a warm, vibrant place to live that has changed in all the best ways possible. I feel like there's no end to the fun, interesting, exciting things to do. People are gravitating back towards the culture that really birthed this region. I think it's only going to get better moving forward.
Great. And then those are words to end on. That was Mark Lynn Ferguson. I'm Douglas Jackson, and you were in Book City, Roanoke. I want to mention one final time that our sponsor for this is Dolores Best at Book No Further down on Roanoke's Historic City Market. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. And go to bookcityroanoke.com for our things literary, including links and images and notes from this episode. And then join us next time when our guest is Liz Long. Liz directs the Roanoke Regional Writers Workshop and is the head of Roanoke Authors Invasion.